Hello, welcome to another episode of Unpacking Neuroqueerness. This is your host, George Muniz Gund. I have my friend X back on the podcast today. Some of you might remember previous episodes with X. It's been a while since we've done an episode, so welcome back, X.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, happy to have you back. Today, X and I are going to talk about insomnia and sleep problems, particularly among the neurodivergent community. Studies have shown that 60 to 80% of neurodivergent people experience sleep struggles throughout their lives, children and adults, compared to only 40% of neurotypicals. We're going to start talking a little bit about why it tends to be more difficult for neurodivergent people compared to neurotypical people.
Do you remember as a kid having trouble sleeping? What are your first memories of that? Because I think that's a very visceral thing a lot of us probably experience.
Yeah. Yeah, so for me, I remember sometimes feeling a lot of energy when I would go to, when it was time to go to bed, and I would catch myself being awake. Sometimes even if I knew I had to be up early in the morning for school, it was really hard because I would try to fall asleep and I couldn't fall asleep because I had so many racing thoughts in my head. So I would end up maybe trying to sleep at 10 p.m. and then sleeping at about 2 a.m. or something like that. And then I would like have to wake up for school at 7 and I would be really, really tired. Same thing with feeling really tired during the day. Because I was so tired because I couldn't sleep well at night, it was really hard for me to stay fully awake and engaged in school. Typical ADHD fashion, I struggled more in the classes that I didn't like. I wasn't as interested in the subject because the classes that I was always very interested in, and it was easier to engage. That's the first thing I started noticing when I was a kid, because like in Brazil, you could go to school either in the morning from like 8 to 12 or something, or 8 to 1, or you could go in the afternoon from like 1 to 5 or 1 to 6.
So that's really interesting.
Yeah, it was, at least the school I was, like, that's how it was in the beginning. Because I remember when I was in elementary school from like 2nd to 5th grade or something, I actually went in the afternoon, and that, in retrospect, was a lot better. But by the time I got to middle school, they didn't have the afternoon option anymore. It was all, like, in the morning. It would happen where I would be really tired in the afternoon after I got home from school, and then I would, like, end up taking a nap in the afternoon, but then I would, because I had napped in the afternoon, I wouldn't fall asleep until later. And then I'd say that throughout my life, it's kind of fluctuated. And then I kind of had some bouts of insomnia again last year, which I will get to later. I wanted to ask you, X, about your experiences with sleeping as a kid.
I tended to try to go to sleep early, and sometimes it would work just because I had woken up at a ridiculous time. I was the kind of kid that would wake up at 3 in the morning for no reason and just not be able to fall asleep. I imagine for my parents was probably terrifying when I was much younger, unsupervised, running around the house. You know, parents gave me interventions and allowed me to make like blanket forts and things, and gave me puzzles and stuff that I could do on my own in my room without leaving the room, until it was an appropriate time for me to either wake them up or, like, you know, go make myself breakfast, which I kind of knew how to do by the time I was 5. A lot of the sleep problems I had was, and I occasionally still get it, is this frustration with being really tired. And I previously had issues with, you know, that classic insomnia problem where you're lying in bed, like, I should be going to sleep, which doesn't help, and then you don't fall asleep and get it upset. I kind of got over that quite quickly, but it was just this sense of, I know I'm tired and I can't go to sleep.
Yeah.
And I'm doing all the things that are supposed to be working and they're not working. And I realized a lot of that has to do with temperature. So most of my nights, even as a child, was spent flipping over cushions to, yeah, like the cool side of whatever, or the duvet or the blanket, yeah, but still not being able to sleep with nothing. So the summer was always the worst, and it usually still is.
Yeah, I have a hard time. I mean, it's, I guess here it's more like, because of the unique climate of the Bay Area, it can be warmer in the fall than it is in the summer. But whenever we have really warm nights here, or in Brazil, like when we would have a really warm night and I didn't have AC, That was probably a little worse because, I mean, I'm on the second floor here, which does get pretty warm. I remember in Brazil, I was on the ninth floor, and it rises. Yeah, it rises. And so I remember sometimes it would be like 26 Celsius or like 80 Fahrenheit when I would go to bed. It's interesting that you mentioned temperature definitely has a huge impact, because I feel like if it's cold, I can just put more blankets on. Like, I remember always thinking since I was a kid, I liked the cold better because I could just put blankets on and it feels cozy. Whereas if it's hot, I feel like I want to rip my skin off and I can't.
You shouldn't. No.
Yeah, I shouldn't.
I mean, living in Russia, that was the one lovely thing about winter, is that you can, it gets really fucking cold, but you know, you can always put more things on.
Yeah.
Always. And even though I get asked this, I think a lot of people don't understand that Russia has different climates. It's not just cold all the time. So I'm just going to reiterate it for those who still don't know. Mm-hmm. It can get warm in the summer.
Yeah, really hot from what I...
In fact, hot.
Yeah.
Yes. Parts of Russia, and I grew up in Moscow. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it goes through the same summer, fall, you know, winter changes.
Yeah.
But I also lived on the top floor of our childhood house. I used to take fitted bed sheets and like douse them in cold water and wrap them around myself. And then I'd wake up or kind of wake up because I've been able to fall asleep 10 minutes later and it would be completely dry.
Mm.
So that was what I would do during the summer instead of, you know, flipping duvets over. I just completely gave up on the idea of having bedding generally, and yeah. I was trying to make do.
I remember always struggling on the warm nights because I like to have something covering me, like even like a little sheet or something, or it just felt, I think maybe in retrospect now, I realize it was probably a sensory sensitivity and I didn't know it at the time, but it always felt weird. Like, I was just too exposed. There was something that was weird if I didn't have anything on me. So I wanted to have at least some kind of sheet or something. It was still, like, sometimes it was just too warm even to have the sheet.
And I think that's something that everyone can relate to. I think, well, I know, to be honest, that even neurotypical people have trouble, obviously, falling asleep when it's hot. And I that's more conditioning. I mean, from a very young age, most kids that I know, at least, you know, are taught to go to sleep with a blanket on, right? So there's this sort of weird associative response to, I have blanket, I am safe, I go to sleep.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to trick your body into feeling safe when it's not covered in something.
Yeah. Colder nights I way prefer, but then I've also realized that in general, I like keeping the room a little bit on the cooler side. I've found that, I mean, most people probably like it warmer, but for me, I like it to be in between 18 and 20 Celsius.
Those are specific. I don't think I ever narrowed down exactly what it is. Although, now that I think about it, whenever my brother and I have shared a room, he has complained that I've taken it down to a certain temperature, but I've never really noticed what it was. But it's interesting that you were like, this is my optimum sleep zone.
Mm-hmm.
No, that must exist between this temperature and that temperature. Everything else is unacceptable.
Yeah, because I was like always really into weather and temperatures, and so I had like a thermometer in my room, and then I was just like, oh, okay. Like, I started just like figuring out, oh, so 20 actually feels pretty good. 22 feels a bit warm. 23 definitely feels warm.
I was never that invested. I was like, it is either too hot or too cold, and otherwise I have no problems. Yeah.
But I didn't even realize how important it was for a while. Like, I knew, oh, okay, I kind of like it cold. But then I was like, oh, like, especially like after experience with CBTI, also known as cognitive behavioral therapy intervention. I ended up working with a sleep doctor last year because I was having like bouts of insomnia again. Yeah, one of the things that came up was like a very, I'll get into like more of the specifics of the treatment, but one of the things was about temperature, and that was like a very minor thing that I hadn't really paid that much attention to. Like, I had observed before that I liked it, but I guess I had just kind of forgotten about it.
But when you're sleeping, what I personally find is that I'll go to bed feeling really warm. For example, what I've started doing is if I feel really warm going to bed, I'll have, you know, a fan, because I live in the UK and we don't have generalized AC. I also didn't have it in Russia, so that's a completely different experience. We don't have the option of creating the optimum sleep temperature experience, you know.
How about for heating, though? Because I mean heating. Like, because I don't have central AC either.
Well, heating, I tend to keep it off. One, for gas reasons.
I see.
Because I usually don't need it very much. I mean, it gets cold here in the UK, but I'm used to things being so freezing back where I'm from.
I see.
Obviously, we do keep it on, but what I've done is put it on a timer. Mm-hmm. And it's something I've had to negotiate with my partner, who has a very different sleeping style. If he, say, has a late shift because he works in transportation, comes back during the winter, I'm asleep, and it's lovely now under blankets, and it's cold. He's just come out from work. He's exhausted. He's probably feeling very cold anyway, and kind of depleted is the word. You don't want to walk into a cold house. Mm-hmm. But then I'll wake up. So we've set up a timer system, which is a whole different thing if you're neurodivergent, you have a neurodivergent partner, and you both have sleeping problems. Mm. These are just conversations you end up having, and you have to make it work, because what works for you or for me doesn't work with two people.
Yeah.
The fact that even people can come back from work and just go to sleep instantly is ridiculous. Going from a high stimulating environment to a low stimulating environment.
Yeah.
It reminds me a lot of being a little kid and someone going, oh, we're, you know, in the living room, everyone's having fun. Time to go to bed, you brush your teeth, wash your face, all that. Then you're just in this dark room while your brain's still going.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing. And for someone like me who has ADHD, I could just feel my brain looking for something.
Yeah.
And as it tends to manifest as your eyes try to start making sense of the darkness, and then it kind of, you know, if you have an imagination, then you start creating monsters in your head, and that's not great.
Mm.
So I did have a nightlight for a while. Not because I was scared, but just I realized in retrospect, because I just needed something, or at least alternatively, at least a segue between the high stimulating environment and then just pitch blackness. And it is dark, you will lie still and you will do nothing, which is hell.
That's hell, yeah.
It's great when it works out, when if you actually can fall asleep, that's all you want. But if you're going from, oh, I don't feel like I'm ready to go to bed yet, to you will now endure torture, that is, you know, it doesn't create the best experiences with trying to fall asleep in the first place.
Yeah.
It comes from a sense of you feeling nervous about going to bed, experiences, especially as a neurodivergent kid, having trouble falling asleep. There's a lot of anxiety and trauma that then gets wound around those early experiences that then also make it difficult when you're an adult.
I see. Okay, that makes sense, because when I was growing up, it was like I always had to be in bed by like 10, but then I wouldn't fall asleep, and it was like because I would be like doing other stimulating things like watching TV, I would do that right until 10 p.m. It wasn't like I had the time to transition to like a quieter, it was just straight to bed, and then it's like darker, mostly dark. And I'm trying to fall asleep, because now I do remember, like, to that time, and I'm like, oh, yeah, that was really challenging, and I didn't have an idea back then of setting the tone, like transitioning, I guess, from being highly stimulated to less stimulated and falling asleep. I did go on a bit of a tangent when I was, like, because I got excited about temperatures.
Temperatures are exciting.
Yeah.
Very important to sleep health and hygiene.
Yeah.
But it's not a tangent, really, I think. I think you're doing yourself a disservice. I think it's paying attention to something that's often overlooked, especially if you're tired or you have chronic sleep problems. Unless it's something that really bothers you, like it does me. Like, I always knew, like, it is too hot. I do not like this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, it leads into what you mentioned before, which is the cognitive behavioral intervention, and how even adults don't know how to set the things we were just talking about, which is that you have to create a pocket of time where you sort of guide your brain to a slightly quieter place instead of just doing what the rest of the world does to us, which is, oh, we're done with you now. You're now a problem. Go to sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So many of us are conditioned to do that with our brains too. And, yeah. And again, neurotypical people have this too.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of them have insomnia. I think the idea that there needs to be sleep hygiene, that when possible there need to be routines to just sort of make your brain and body go like, oh, maybe I should start trying to think about calming down now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's
something that people like you and I who are neurodivergent have more trouble with, because we'll forget to do it. If we don't have timers, we'll be like, oh, I'm so interested in this thing or this thing or whatever. And it's like, oh, it is now 3 a.m. Cool. You know, it's really important for everyone to be like, I need to turn my lights down to a certain kind of light or set a timer or do things, or even lavender sprays, which are really nice, things like that. Just to trick the brain into going, oh, perhaps we should begin to contemplate resting. Not that it's actually possible for anyone with ADHD, but perhaps we should contemplate the idea that it could be possible.
Yeah, exactly.
But what worked for you? Like, what did you get out of your experience when you had talked to an actual sleep person?
I think one of the first things he told me was about setting cutoff times. The first week, it was just basically figuring out how long I tended to sleep on average, because he did explain to me that not everyone needs 8 hours, which is something we also hear a lot from an early age. Like, I had certainly heard that a lot about there being like
drinking a certain amount of water every day as well. Like, there's certain things, like, some people need more, some people need less. It's not just the 8 hours.
Yeah, exactly. So he like told me about that, and he was like, oh, some people like only need like 6 or 7, and we're gonna figure out like how much you usually sleep, and then based on that determined a bedtime and a wake time. But then in order to like train my body to adapt to that, the first thing he said, like with the cutoff times, is like, okay, so your tentative bedtime is 11:20, so at 9 p.m. roughly a little over 2 hours before, you want to cut off. He told me to cut off like heavy activities, because before, like, sometimes up until bedtime I would be like working on my next script or like on another project, you know, doing like a little weather briefing video, which I just started doing recently. And
great, by the way, I love those.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. But that was very like, I realized, oh yeah, I'm activating my brain like a lot, like right before bed. So then that was helpful. Then he was like, you know, listen to a podcast or like read a book, or even he said even watch like some light TV. He said ideally to not do screens, but he said it is okay if it's not very activating. You don't want to watch a super like intense horror show or whatever and then be like, or not even horror, but just anything that's like really activating. So then that was helpful too, because then I started to adjust to that more, and I think it probably took some time. I started to fall into that routine, and I think it was also like being autistic and having a thirst for routine and patterns. I was like, oh, okay, patterns, oh, goals, like time, like routine, oh, okay, 9 p.m. this, and then I was like, okay, 9 p.m., I want to be like this. And
my brain, because when my parents started teaching me that, my little age secret, rules. No, yeah, not for us.
I can see how it wouldn't work out if you're not autistic, like if you have ADHD and you're not autistic, or it's...
Oh, don't get me wrong. It does help. The routines do help. Mm-hmm. I'm not denying that. Just the reaction my brain has had to it versus what you're describing, which is, oh yes, a guideline. I would love that. Thank you. My brain going, I think we are, we don't follow this. We're probably the one person on this earth that this does not apply to, while knowing full well, of course it will. But like, there's, you embracing this structure with open arms and me just being like, nice try.
Yeah, no, I can see that happening, ADHD. Yeah.
It's still helpful though. That's the annoying bit, is that they're right. These people are right.
Yeah, no, it did. Over time, I realized, oh yeah, like this really helps. And then like another thing was the like cutting off alcohol 4 hours before, so roughly 7 p.m. Because another thing I had noticed is that if I had a drink with like a glass of wine or whatever with dinner before, and it was like only a couple hours before bed, I would almost always wake up in the middle of the night. And then I realized that, oh, okay, I had never thought about, like, just doing it earlier. It's pretty much moved through by the time you go to bed. And then also he told me, and I don't have caffeine very often, but, like, occasionally I'll have, like, a caffeinated beverage. He told me to stop drinking caffeine after 2 p.m.
It stays in your system for at least another 6 hours.
Yeah, which was another huge one that I hadn't realized. I had always thought, like, I can have a caffeinated beverage at 5 p.m. and I'll be fine because by the time that it's 11, but I'm like, oh, I should cut off before then.
There's the whole thing about ADHD medication that people talk about as well, and like, say, caffeine, right? Where there's this concern, and for some people, it's true. That if they're on the wrong dose or the wrong kind of medication, that it will keep them from sleeping. That's a huge concern for people who start ADHD medication because it's a stimulant. My experience with it is that I've had trouble when my dose has been too low of ADHD medication. Yeah. Once me and my doctor figured out what the right dose was for me, I actually slept better because I was expending energy in a way that was more productive and easier to gauge during the day, so that by the time I needed to go to sleep, and I would take it at the right time as well, I was completely ready for sleep. For anyone who does have concerns about ADHD medication interfering with your sleep, it is very important to figure out whether you have the right kind of delivery system for the kind of medication you have, like Ritalin, Concerta. Is it extended release? Is it short release? Are you taking it at the right time? Are you taking it too late? Are you, because things like that can really affect it. But if you have the right dose, it's been shown that a lot of people with ADHD find it easier to sleep, which is really interesting. Mm-hmm. You'd think that, like common parlance about methamphetamines is that it'll keep you awake, and mm-hmm. it will if you abuse them or you don't take them properly. But mm-hmm. if your brain needs them, it'll just finally, by the time it's done, it's like, and we have created the chemicals we needed to today, and we are now done, instead of trying to find other things to latch onto because just there's something missing.
Yeah, that makes sense, yeah. Another thing, part of like the whole CBTI thing that helped me a lot was avoiding long naps during the day, because I would sometimes, if I didn't sleep well during the day, in the afternoon, I would get really tired, and I would let myself sleep for an hour or two. Like, I think I was aware to like not sleep for like 3 or 4 hours. I used to think, oh, an hour or two is okay, but then then the sleep doctor was like, try to not nap at all, unless maybe like if you have to drive somewhere and you need to get a little bit of rest. He said in that case you can do 30 minutes.
Well, people have circadian rhythms, right? So you have sleep rhythms that are in touch with energy, and certain hormones and chemicals are depending on how tired you are, which also, by the way, one of the ways that the body copes, and you see this in kids who haven't got enough sleep, is your brain becomes more hyperactive, which mm-hmm. is funny for someone with ADHD, because I experience that quite a bit, where I'm tired and I start acting mm-hmm. like a toddler because my brain's like trying to keep me awake.
Yeah.
So it gives me all this energy, even though I have nothing, even if I haven't slept the night before.
Yeah.
It runs on that and cortisol, mm-hmm. which is similar to adrenaline, but it mm-hmm. stays in your body for longer. Mm-hmm. If you nap and you have to, I've never been a napper, annoyingly, for my parents, just could never do it. There was too much going on when the people would tell me to nap, like even in preschool. Mm-hmm. I was like, no.
Yeah.
You want to stall, just stop in the middle of the day and go to sleep. Not happening. No. So I, to my parents' dismay, was never a napper. Mm-hmm. However, my brother and my partner both love naps.
Mm-hmm.
They both struggle as well with going to sleep occasionally.
Yeah.
And I can tell with them, it's interesting, they need naps because they're autistic and have to deal with the world, and sometimes it's too exhausting,
mm-hmm.
which I think is slightly different and something your doctor maybe took into consideration. I'm sure they did. A lot of my autistic friends do end up needing naps, but they've been recommended nothing more than, say, mm-hmm. what you were saying, 30 minutes to 45 minutes,
mm-hmm.
which has something to do with completing a small bit of your sleep cycle.
Yeah.
So that you don't completely restart or interfere with what your body's trying to regulate.
Exactly. Because he explained, because like I hadn't realized, like I had always thought of the circadian rhythm of just like one graph, or like I just thought about it as like one side of like an energy fluctuation, like up and down. But then he explained that there's, like, two sides of it. Because, like, I remember he showed me this graph that was, like, it had bars on top and it had bars below. And so he was, like, there's your energy side, but then there's also, like, your rest side. During a typical night when you wake up, if you're well-rested, your rest side will be, like, the rest bar will be pretty much empty because, like, you used up the rest. And your energy bar will will be full because like you have a full tank of energy. With napping, you started the day with only like 50% of your rest bar filled and 50% of your energy bar. So your energy bar gets pretty low by the afternoon. If you nap, you're going to fill up your rest bar. You'll deplete your bar, but you'll increase your energy bar again. And then it made a lot of sense because I'm like, oh yeah, because then I have too much energy. So then when 11 p.m. comes around, I'm probably not going to sleep until 2.
What's interesting about what you're also saying is that this isn't the case that you don't have lots of sleep debt, which is a whole different concept. Mm-hmm. Because that stuff accrues over time.
Yeah.
So what he's explaining, which is that you have a certain amount of energy if you're not completely sleep deprived all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And things sort of even themselves out, and you have to deplete a certain amount of energy because your brain's like, oh no, I have more energy because I took a nap. That naps are helpful, for example, for people who have serious sleep debt. If you didn't sleep at all, you should probably take that nap because, again, you might be driving or doing other things. Mm-hmm. Like, naps are important. There's no reason to not have them unless it's really messing with your sleep.
Mm-hmm.
In which case you do kind of have to cut it cold turkey and be like, I need to just make it to an acceptable time for bed. And it's really brutal for some people. Mm-hmm. And again, if you're working a safety critical job, please go take a nap. Mm-hmm. You deserve it.
Yeah.
But in the long term, it's not always a sustainable way of managing what is obviously the symptom of a schedule that doesn't work for you, because that's the problem. Yeah. Having troubles with sleep is difficult, and you can manage it with rituals and routines and lovely lavender spray and keeping the light at a certain thing, and we'll put links to this in the podcast description to blue light filters on your computer, so that if you input your waking time, it'll slowly decrease the amount of blue light on your computer. So say if you do really want to watch something, it'll be less detrimental to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But all of those things, one, if you're neurodivergent, probably have a difficult time keeping track of, and that is completely fine. There's nothing wrong with you if you're neurodivergent. Yeah. Like, this is too much. Yeah, it feels like too much. Neurotypical people also feel like it's too much. But it's also a sign that there's something in the way that your body functions, the way, you know, some people are morning people. I am. My partner is not. They get their energy spike no matter when they've woken up, really, in the evening, and I just don't. I wake up at 5.
Mm-hmm.
their happiest, like, peak energy time is between 6 p.m. and 3 a.m.
Yeah.
So it's, it's just very different.
Mm-hmm.
And he does a job that requires him to have a constantly changing schedule, which is hell for him. He's managed to make it work, and he takes naps, and he's finally kind of figured out a system. But at the beginning, it was a perfect example of being forced into a routine that, one, doesn't work for your brain, because he had no routine for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
That fucked with his head. But also that he was dealing with the fact that he was waking up at times that made no sense to his body. And then he was doing training and was being asked to take in information very quickly that his brain was just not awake for. He took it in because he's a very bright, very diligent person, but it was just made that much more difficult. And it's not something you can really change. There's a lot of articles like, how to become a morning person? Like, You can make things easier for yourself, like maybe don't have a hangover. That is the easiest example.
Yeah.
Just don't have a hangover. Very easy. Then perfect morning person, right? Yeah. But some people are just not like that, and they never will be. And to try and force them to be is kind of silly.
I agree, yeah.
It's like getting neurodivergent people and being like, you have to sit here at this school and focus on little sleep, because it's made you, in your case, wake up at a time that does not work for your body clock.
Yeah.
We are very disappointed that you did not do well. And you're just sitting there like, I've been set up to fail.
Nothing, yeah.
Instead of learn to be like, okay, so what works for me? And if you're in a situation that, like my partner, there's times you have to wake up really early and you don't really want to.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
You have to find ways. Like, he does occasionally take naps because he needs them, and he works with the public because he's on transport. But also because he has constantly shifting schedules, sometimes he takes a nap earlier in the day, or he takes one, like, he'll wake up like he did today on his day off, have breakfast, which is like 11, 12, in the day, and then take a nap right afterwards.
Yeah.
For another hour. And then, he's back on a normal schedule, and it makes no sense to me, but it does work for him.
Yeah. When my sleep doctor suggested the 11:20 p.m. sleep time for me, it threw me off a bit. It was like, but that seems really late. Because I just remembered, like, when I was a kid and I was like, oh, you have to be, when I had to be in bed at 10. And then especially because I had school in the morning. But then when it was like, it was also just because it had become really ingrained, the idea that, no, I have to sleep at 10 p.m. because otherwise it's considered too late by most people or just by standards. But I'm like, oh, if I'm able to change my schedule and figure out a schedule, to have the flexibility of figuring out a schedule that works for me.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think what you're alluding to also is the idea that if you, and a lot of neurodivergent people, as I mentioned before, do have a delayed, we call it melatonin window, which we'll talk about melatonin in a little bit. That's the thing that prompts your brain. You see darkness outside, your eyes go, okay,
yeah.
Information, dark. Mm-hmm. Should probably start creating this chemical.
Yeah.
But because it's serotonin and dopamine dependent as well, a lot of people with ADHD have difficulty because your dopamine is supposed to lower and your melatonin is supposed to go up.
Yeah.
If your dopamine receptors don't work properly or not in the way that you regulate things in a way that is helpful to you at all times, you might not create enough melatonin. Or you find something really interesting, saying you have weather video or, you know, yeah, a special interest thing, the dopamine goes up and the melatonin's like, oh, we're out of here, we don't need
exactly to be here. That's what would happen to me. Yeah.
Whereas most people, the melatonin is much more persistent.
Yeah.
Typical, like, that part of your brain is like, we are definitely shutting off. Whereas, again, speaking from an ADHD perspective, on one hand, for your brain in any situation to be like, oh, this is interesting, we're going to turn everything on again, is really fascinating. It can be, quote unquote, a superpower. It's not, but it's an interesting skill. Really important is happening, or something urgent, and you can just be on all of a sudden. But when you're understimulated, you see something that you really like, and your brain doesn't necessarily manage your neurochemistry in a way that is necessarily always helpful to you at all times, it can be frustrating, because you can feel your brain going, oh, this is interesting, and then your body feels alert, and then you want to do everything, and part of melatonin does, it just calms everything the fuck down.
Yeah.
That also is affected by, if you were forced to go to sleep at a time when you went from high energy to low energy, lights turn off, your brain has too much dopamine because of all this stuff going on. Anxiety also keeps melatonin from happening because it tricks your brain into thinking, oh, we need to be awake. We need to be awake because something's going to happen. Or something will happen tomorrow, and we need to think it through, and we need to do this stuff. And that all affects the way that your brain is trying to shut down. Your brain doesn't fall asleep all at the same time. There's parts of the brain that are more active than others at certain times, and there's different waves of sleep. So everyone knows what REM is, which is the rapid eye movement, which is what it's called after, which is what people consider deep sleep. One, it's not just like sleep or no sleep. There's a kind of middle ground. Sleep disorders, turns out, are more likely when it doesn't just go from one stage to the other. They tend to overlap. It's like one part of the brain will kind of wake up while the other one goes more to sleep.
Okay.
More neurodivergent people tend to have sleep disorders than non-neurodivergent people.
Yeah.
Not just sleep problems, but actual disorders. Sleep paralysis, snoring, insomnia, REM disorder, or whatever it's called, when your body actually acts out what you're doing in your dreams, which is horrifying. It's because your brain isn't regulating the chemicals in a way that shuts down certain parts of your brain in the right way.
Yeah, I was gonna mention sleep paralysis. I was gonna ask if you've experienced that before too, because I have.
Thankfully, no. But I know a lot of people who are neurodivergent have.
I have, yeah. It's not, oh my god, it's really scary. The first few times that I experienced it was when I was a teenager, and maybe that had to do with that, you know, being in puberty.
Hormones do fuck everything up.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a reason that teenagers need more sleep. It's because it fucks everything up.
Because I had never really experienced anything like that before. I would wake up and I would be fully awake and conscious and unable to move. I'm like, what's going on? Like, it felt like I was like, but it's like, it's not even a coma because I'm conscious, but I can't move at all. And thankfully, I don't remember having like hallucinations, but I do hear that some people do. They see like a big dark shadow or like monster-like creature or something, like.
The paralysis demon, as we now know it on the internet, right? It's interesting you mentioned the hallucinations, because that tends to happen either if you haven't slept very well, or people who are prone to narcolepsy tend to see more hallucinations before and after they have narcoleptic episodes. But the reason that, say, you woke up with sleep paralysis, many people do, is that motor function that keeps you from most people from acting out their dreams. Mm-hmm. And some people do have sleep disorders like this, which is, you know, they have to put mittens on themselves and wrap themselves up so they don't hurt anybody, which is, you know, terrifying.
Yeah.
It's really deep in the brain. It's like what we would call the lizard brain is still on. Like the fact that we're off, I guess, the fact that it's your brain is like, oh, we're still kind of asleep.
Yeah.
It's just a bit of a delay.
Yeah, I read about it being like a delay. Your brain wakes up before your body.
Well, technically, there's parts of your brain thing are waking up before other parts have learned to shift to a different kind of mode.
I see.
Again, it is really interesting, this concept that the entire brain shuts off when it obviously doesn't. I mean, we know this because we breathe, right? That would be very inconvenient.
Yeah.
There has to be some level of brain activity going on for us to be able to be alert if danger happens, if we hear loud noises. There's always something going on. And actually in nature, most animals sleep monohemispherically, I think is the term. So ducks, for example, can turn one side of their brain off. So if you ever see a whole group of ducks on the water, they usually have one eye open and they will then shift sides. Because in nature, if you have, you know, if you have predators, it actually doesn't make sense to fall asleep, which is why for the longest time, people didn't understand why humans did.
Mm-hmm.
People still say, we don't know why we sleep. I mean, we know the benefits of sleep, I think is fair. It helps cleanse the brain of certain things, of chemicals that are unhelpful. You know, so stress, all of that, it's sort of like a putting your Pokemon at the charging station in that little hospital thing.
Mm-hmm.
It does that. It obviously helps us produce certain proteins and chemicals within our body that help regenerate / repair trauma to both our brain and our tissue. But for the longest time, and doctors are still trying to properly answer this question, like, why can't we not do this when we're, you know, semi-hemispherically again? Like, because it is a danger to us, to some extent, to not be somewhat alert.
Yeah.
This is the answer. Neurodivergent people, again, evolutionarily, we have certain benefits, right? We very good in extreme situations.
Yeah.
You know, shepherds and autistic people, excellent. Like, you know, just out there with the sheep, counting the sheep, not talking to anyone but the sheep, great, right? Just as an example. But unfortunately, that means that if neurodivergent people are more aware of their surroundings, you have sensory issues, your nerve endings, which then, that's the heat sensory stuff. You know, you feel that more intensely most of the time if you're neurodivergent. It's going to keep your brain awake.
Yeah, yeah. That I noticed, like, even, like, so, like, I'll go to an environment that's a lot warmer and it'll really throw me off. I remember a few years ago I had a partner and there was one time that I stayed at their place. So I think they like to sleep warm. And so, like, I was mentioning earlier how I figured out that, like, 67 to 68 is a good temperature for me, and they kept theirs at 72, and I definitely felt it, and then it was like, that was even before I did the whole CBT thing, and I figured out, like, these little tips about, like, temperature.
They're all connected, all of this stuff.
Yeah, and then I was like, oh my god, no wonder it was so hard for me to sleep in that room, because it was so warm, and just, like, in general, like, whenever I would go somewhere, and for whatever reason, like, I wouldn't have control over the temperature, or it was, like, too warm. Because at least when it's a cold night, and if you have a heater, you can kind of...
Then you can warm up, but you can never take your skin off. Even in sleep studies with neurotypical people, you put them in a new environment, they're not going to sleep as well.
Yeah.
So they tend to do 2-day, 3-day, even week-long sleep studies. Mm-hmm. But the first night is usually just give it away free.
Yeah.
Because, say, even if it is comfortable or you're neurotypical, I mean, sleep labs aren't comfortable because you have to wear wires and things in your head. But take the idea of going to a new place, like some hotels are really nice. You still don't sleep most of the time as well as you think you're going to, considering how nice it is the first night.
Yeah, it's an adjustment. Yeah, that makes sense, because, like, I do feel that when I'm traveling as well, like, even if I have a comfortable bed or a comfortable room, it's just a different environment. It can take a little bit to adjust, yeah.
which is going back to your cognitive behavioral intervention, which is that it's about familiar things that your brain, and anyone's brain, regardless of whether neurodivergent or not, can associate with sleep to help with going, the melatonin go. It's your job to tell me to go to sleep now. I take melatonin tablets. I find them helpful. Other people may not. I would suggest you talk to your doctor before taking them. For me personally, it helps kind of initiate that window of you need to go to sleep now.
Yeah.
It's not like a sleep medication necessarily, but it just sort of, my brain's like, oh, we don't have enough of this. This is great.
Yeah.
Again, that in addition to, say, exercising during the day, doing things, not napping, right, in your case, too much or at all, and making sure you follow certain routines, which for some of us seems nicer to some people than to others, but it is still helpful.
Mm-hmm.
It's like training a pet or going to the gym. You will sometimes fall out of practice, but it might get a bit hard. But if you keep trying to be persistent rather than consistent, your brain will sort of be like, I see you trying, man, it's fine.
Yeah.
People with insomnia, it's even harder because it feels like your brain is against you.
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
It's hard not to be angry at oneself, understandably, mm-hmm. right? But that just makes things worse. So it's kind of like, take your brain by the proverbial hand and go, do you want chamomile tea? Do you want lavender? Do you want hot or cold bath? Like, just find a routine that works for you. Any other thing that we've talked about on this podcast with you before, most of the things people suggest don't necessarily work for us, and it sucks, and we have to figure it out on our own.
Yeah.
And it's personalized, and there's no rules that actually work all the time, and bleh, like...
Yeah, no, it gets really, like, tiring sometimes, because I get it, like, some people, something works for them, but then they assume that it works for everybody, and they're like, no, you just need to do this, you just need to try this.
Then again, for you, it's as simple as going from what you thought had to be a 10 p.m. bedtime to an hour and almost a half later. It's not that big of a thing, but for your brain, it was like, oh, this is what we needed.
Yeah.
This makes more sense.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's that simple.
Yeah.
I mean, plus other things, but like small interventions like that you mentioned really were helpful.
Yeah, it was. Even just shifting like the mindset from, oh, I need to be asleep by 10 p.m. because it's 10 p.m. to I need to find the right schedule that works for me.
Bedtime. And your job and what you do during the day, which is not always compatible, but there's a middle ground somewhere. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of that is just, I think, speaking to before, is frustration that it's not working. It keeps you up, right?
Yeah, exactly. It was keeping me up.
Did you have racing thoughts about it? Was that something that you had in your head if you couldn't sleep? Can you recall what was going on in your head, like what you would tell yourself?
Yeah, I would get, part of it was just getting frustrated because I wasn't falling asleep. I would just start thinking about something that happened earlier in the day or something that I was working on. And then I just like start thinking about that and going in loops. And then eventually I'll catch myself and I'll be like, oh, wait, I'm supposed to be falling asleep. And I'm thinking about this thing. And it was just a lot of like racing thoughts and getting like clinging on to like certain thoughts and then my brain just going in all directions.
Yeah. And if you're tired, you don't always have control over whether you think about that thing or not, right? Especially if you're neurodivergent.
Yeah.
My example of that is, again, I work as an investigative journalist. It can be quite an intense job. And as I mentioned earlier, my partner's sleep schedule is very different from mine. So their peak time for watching the news is like 6, 7 p.m., whereas I've been up at like 5, 6 a.m. dealing with the news most of the day. And unless there's something that I need to be working on or something really major that I need to have some involvement in or be on top of, I think journalists just generally, if you want to be successful in the long term, you do have to learn to turn it off.
Mm-hmm.
There's a cutoff time for the news unless something terrible is happening, which is at all times, but I think people understand what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. So for me, like, I'm sitting there trying to, you know, enjoying my book or my podcast or my low-lit, very not intense television show, right?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I hear BBC News, two people have just died because of an attack that I researched heavily earlier that day. And I'll be like, I really don't need to hear this right now.
Yeah.
So, you know, it does cause problems and it ways to figure out is like maybe I wear earphones, maybe I go into a different room until a certain time when I go to sleep. But again, that is the same example. Like, it's learning, like the gym, you need to just learn to cut off.
Mm-hmm.
or even if you have anxious thoughts, I'm sure a lot of people can relate to this.
Yeah.
It's practice. It's not always great. It's like that little muscle power up in the gym. It's teaching your brain to be like, noticed it, no. So that when you do have insomnia and you are really anxious and it's really, really difficult to not berate yourself for not being able to sleep or maintain proper sleep hygiene, there's some muscle memory in your brain that's like, we are going to not do that now. We actually are going to go watch this television show or read this book because that's what we're trained to do.
I see. Yeah.
It seems like that's what you got from your intervention therapy stuff, is like a guideline to do that.
Yeah.
Which more people would be access to be honest.
It's true. I guess another thing that I wanted to ask is like when we were talking about darkness. So even like down here, because I know I'm at a lower latitude than you, but still like it gets, there's a significant difference. I mean, I know for you it's more, but like 8 p.m., like here in the summer, it won't really get dark until like 9 p.m., I think 8:30 or 9. And in the winter, it'll be fully dark around 5.
Growing up in Russia, we have white nights during the summer in certain places. Mm-hmm. St. Petersburg's famous for this, where the sun doesn't go down.
Yeah.
On the opposite spectrum of that, in the same city, in St. Petersburg or Moscow, I remember waking up to go to school or getting ready to go to school at like 4:35. And then I'd get to school at, say, 7. It was still slightly dark. You'd be at school. By the time it's 3 p.m., it's the sun is already setting. Like, there's no sun whatsoever. And it, again, that also messes with the melatonin kind of thing in your brain. Your brain's like, light, no light, all light, do not know when to release the chemical, you know?
Yeah. Because, like, how is it, like, because in the UK, it also, like, there's quite a difference. Like, it gets dark pretty late and in the summer and pretty early in the winter, right?
Yeah, there is a difference. The lovely thing about modern technology is now we have things like blue lights and gradual alarm clocks, which for anyone who has trouble waking up, I got one for my partner recently and they love it. For anyone who doesn't know what it is, it's where the light turns on very, very slowly up until the time where you want it to actually wake you up. And the noises get louder as well, so it's a gradual wake up.
Oh, okay, I see.
So if you're someone who is very groggy in the morning, very sleepy, or as my partner puts it, feels like is being born again every morning, which must be horrifying. I don't envy you. I can imagine the worst thing in the world being a loud noise or bright lights out of nowhere, right?
Yeah.
That's why babies cry. So again, we'll put the link in description. There's things like gradual light alarms with the sound from the light, where it kind of, your brain, with even though your eyes are closed, kind of understands that the light is turning on.
Yeah.
It has made it a lot easier for people like him, and sometimes I use my own one just because it's helpful for everyone. It's great.
Yeah, interesting. I didn't know about that. That's cool. Yeah.
Some people don't mind having a loud noise. Some people, like, if you think he's autistic, it's the worst thing in the world, right? You're like peacefully sleeping, best thing, you're comfortable, and all of a sudden there's just a sensory problem, and that's how you greet the day. It's not a great way to start off your day as being angry at the world, you know?
That's something I've always disliked a bit about alarms. Like, I know they'll get the job done, but it's intense because you're like asleep. You're nice and mellow, and then all of a sudden there's this, like, sound. This loud sound. It makes me think of my cat when she's just, like, relaxing on the bed and everything is completely chill and maybe I'm working on my computer and then all of a sudden, like, she'll see a bird and it's just like that. It's like within a fraction of a second there'll be this thump and she'll just jump and then she's in hunting mode. But it's just,
that's not how you want to wake up.
No. But it's funny, it's like
about cats though, is that their brains are much better at adjusting, actually. I've done studies on this between being able to fall asleep, you know, wake up because they hear something and then go straight back to sleep. I've had this with my cat. He gets very freaked out when he can't wake me up or my partner because he thinks we're dead. Because he doesn't understand. Most cats, if they hear anything, they can very quickly wake up, go back to sleep. Because their nervous system regulates itself quite well. Unless they have, you know, a disorder or they have hormonal problems. Which is why a lot of people's cats will freak out if they can't wake them up. Because they don't understand. They're like, your nervous system doesn't regulate as well as ours, and so you just still sleeping, even though you heard loud noise, makes no sense. And to be honest, they're right. It's what causes sleep problems, is our brain is not as adept at turning everything on and off
Yeah.
in the right sequence, in the right way, and that is even more difficult for people whose neurochemistry is, well, divergent.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Does your cat also know when you're awake? She wants me to like get up and like either play or give her more food at a certain time. And what I used to try to just like not move or not make any noise, and
Oh, they know.
they know that, like, and then I read, I don't know if that's what it is, but I read something one time about like they can tell by your breathing patterns,
I
like.
don't know enough about. I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, cats are a great example, actually, except they regulate their sleep really well and take all the naps. So other than that, which is the entire point of this episode, in terms of cats are very similar to autistic people. They need routine. And cats who misbehave, or not misbehave, but don't seem to behave appropriately around nighttime, it's a very simplified version of what we've been talking about, is that they've been put, there's whole shows about this, and vets that talk about this. You have to teach your cat, their brain is very much focused on routine in a way that we understand as neurodivergent people. This should happen at this time of day. We regulate ourselves at this time of night. If you exhaust them during the day, they're more likely to sleep at an appropriate time. If you give them irregular sleep times, they will annoy the fuck out of you. And rightly so, because they're like, I don't know what the baseline for when sleep is anymore. It's kind of like having to treat yourself like your favorite cat. You're like, it's fine, we just need to tire you out. And then now we go to bed. But first, like with this noise, and we sit here for a certain amount of time, like it's just refiguring. Because it's very similar. It's not, I mean, it's mammalian, really. So.
No, it makes sense. I feel like it's almost like our schedules are, they're not too out of sync, but it's like she still wakes up and it's almost there, but she still wakes up like an hour or two before I'm ready to wake up.
Well, that's her body clock, that's her natural rhythm, unfortunately. So you do what my parents did and find her like an interactive toy or something she can play with until you're up, Instead of having cat or in my parents' case, little toddler me coming up to them at 3 in the morning going like, I need something to do now. And they're like, absolutely the fuck not. There's two of you. There's you and your brother. We're not ready yet. It's 3 in the morning. It has to be very kind because everyone needs sleep. That's the most difficult thing when you haven't had enough of it, is how quickly just like all of that seems to.
Yeah,
Great.
it builds. Like I realized that it does affect like my sensory mood, the energy, just my general energy throughout the day. For those that are familiar with, I did an episode a long time ago about spoon theory.
Again, it's similar, like if you have a chronic illness, which I also do, there's times where you think you're resting but you're not. Similar, like you think you're sleepy but you're not. You just have to try and be as consistent as possible without freaking yourself out when you're not, because that makes it worse. Because then that becomes a sort of obsessive thing. You might be having a great time scheduling your sleep and doing everything quote unquote perfectly, which is not a real thing. And then like one night goes off or you're don't go to bed for 5 minutes in the way that you thought you would, and then all of a sudden everything is off. And that's just not how the way things work. Your brain does, neurodivergent people have slightly less of a buffer, as we very well know, but we still do have a buffer. Okay, so it wasn't exactly the same today, but that doesn't mean that everything we've done in the past is completely for naught now.
Yeah, I also noticed myself getting really stressed, of course, or more, and I guess this has to do with the spoons, but because I start the day with like a lot less energy. If I haven't slept well, I find myself more triggered by certain situations, or someone says something to me and I'm like slightly annoyed by it. Like on a regular day, I might not be annoyed by it, but if I didn't, it really started realizing how important it is for stress too, like sleep, because yeah, if I don't sleep well, particularly if I don't sleep well for a few nights in a row, I really start to feel it.
It's harder, I think, for some people to regulate how they not only treat themselves but treat others when they're tired. That's men mostly tend to do this, I've noticed. Not saying that women don't, but I think we've been taught to repress most of it, not always successfully. Anyone with a tired mother knows, poor mom. The reason that it becomes more difficult and it's so much easier to snap is because your body produces, again, a stress hormone called cortisol, which is like a longer version of adrenaline. Adrenaline just sort of spikes, goes down. Cortisol just sort of stays there. And yeah. It does higher levels in your body for long periods of time. So what happens if in any form of trauma or prolonged trauma or lack of sleep, it will temporarily shrink parts of your brain. Trying to keep you to survive. So like things like your frontal cortex, I think. So things that regulate how you treat other people or like ideas of sociability, long-term thinking about consequences, that tends to sort of become less important because cortisol's in your body going like, we need to do what makes us feel good now. We need to, which is why there's so many researchers that are still trying to figure out the relationship between ADHD and lack of sleep.
Yeah.
It's more that it informs each other, but it works. And you can see this in neurotypical people again, too. Like everyone knows if you have a friend who hasn't slept for ages, they're probably going to lash out at you at some point.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's nothing personal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Also lash out at yourself first. I think that's what I've noticed with neurodivergent people. They get mad at themselves first when they're tired.
Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely.
My executive function is shit. Mm-hmm. It's not working the way it should, even though I know it's not doing well today. And then after all of that, sleep is like a huge hug for your brain. Everyone deserves a hug.
Yeah, true. Well, those are all the notes I have on my end. I wanted to leave it open in case if you had anything else you wanted to touch on.
Yeah, we'll list all the tips that we put in this podcast in the description notes. There's one thing that I couldn't quite stick in there that I think people who have trouble with what we mentioned at the top of this podcast being temperature regulation. A few years ago, I discovered eucalyptus sheets. Now, they might not work for everyone, but just on a kind of like physics scientific level, they don't absorb heat quite as well as cotton does. The sheets stay cooler for a longer period of time.
That sounds good. Like, that sounds like something that I could potentially benefit from. Because I do having that cool feeling, like, especially if it is a warm night.
It can be slightly more expensive, but again, some people have silk sheets for this reason. I find silk sheets really slippy and weird.
Mm.
These are not that slippy, but they have a similar feeling. It's like a mix. It's like the perfect in between of that lovely, soft, cool feeling that, you know, that kind of silky texture has, and then the softness of cotton.
Yeah.
And it's eco-friendly. It can be slightly more expensive, but you also don't have to wash it as often either. Yeah.
That's good.
Because you don't sweat in it as much. So.
Yeah.
And we'll put a link to the description of ones in the UK, and I'll find some in the US that are viable options, and I'm sure you can provide something else after some research. But it made a huge difference to my sleep. And if I'd had that as a kid, again, it's amazing. It's like that hour difference for you. Just eucalyptus sheets for me.
Yeah.
Much less trouble falling asleep, and it was a revelation. Yeah. And if anyone else can have that happen to them, I am so happy that you found us.
Me too. Yes. That's good to know.
You're welcome, and I hope you sleep well.
Yes. I wanted to thank you again for coming on the podcast. And
my pleasure.
And we will post those notes, the resources and links below. Thank you everyone for listening. And
sweet dreams.
Sweet dreams. And I'll see you next time. Yeah.